We're sponsored by Requeered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com. Coming up, Justine and I chat with another podcaster who has a crime series of his own, and Marco Ramonte joins me and talks about orphan children, cycles on the plane, and what lies beneath the streets of Oxford. I'm Brad Shreve, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Hey, Justine, did you know we have a guest today?
Oh, yeah. I heard that rumor.
Well, I hope you know, because he should be right on your screen.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't know, you're not paying attention.
Well, you don't know. I often have lots of windows open for all my various notes on books and things to chat with you about.
Well, it's Jeff Adams. You know his voice very well, because I know you're a fan of the Big Gay Fiction podcast.
I am.
And Jeff is here today. We're going to talk about his show, of course, and we're going to talk about, he is also a writer. I know another person that is a podcaster and a writer as well, so it happens sometimes. Hello, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Brad. Hi, Justine. Thanks for having me here.
So I actually have a question before we begin, Jeff. Which came first?
We have a question before we begin the questions?
Yes, a question before we begin the questions. That's exactly it.
Okay, this is going to be a good day.
Which came first, writing or podcasting?
Writing.
So we're going to start talking off about writing. I actually thought, you've been podcasting for a number of years, I actually thought writing was a new thing for you, and then I realized it wasn't.
I knew better.
Yes, I know. Why don't you tell us about it?
So the writing essentially began in... Well, pre-2010. 2010 is when the first short story came out. I actually had two shorts come out relatively closely. There's one called The Adventures of Jake, which was about a college guy who worked in a comic book store who kind of was able to get together with his crush, which was kind of fun as a first story. And that went into an anthology published back in the day by Starbucks. And then I had another story called Rivals, which was my first story that involved a hockey player. And this was a little holiday romance about two guys who had known each other. They were cross-town rivals between their high schools and played hockey. And now they're back home. They're adults. They're out of college, in the workplace. But they come back home for Christmas and make that reconnection over the holidays that kind of leads them towards their happily ever after. From there, I wrote more and more and then moved into novels. And
speaking of crosstown, how is it that you're a fan of both the Penguins and the Red Wings?
Justina's done her homework.
I've got a husband who's got the Penguin fan, so.
And so when you grow up in Flint, you know, the Red Wings are kind of in your blood. And went to at least one game a season down in Detroit while I still live there. So there was probably about five Detroit Red Wings games in person that I went to at the old Joe Louis Arena. I got into the Penguins because of Mario Lemieux. Such an incredible player to watch.
Yeah.
That it didn't really matter what team he played for, that, you know, he was such a draw. And the team was so good in the heyday of Lemieux and Jagr. That I was hooked at that after that, and I got to see Lemieux play a couple of times before he ultimately retired.
Okay, you guys are talking hockey, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Because I have one more thing to just see if Jeff might be amused by this. Do you know that Jaromir Scrambled is Mario Jr.?
That's amazing, and
isn't
the most
it,
awesome thing.
It's
I did not know
great.
That.
All right, back to you, Brett.
I knew you guys were talking some kind of sports ball, and you totally lost me. And then when you mentioned the Penguins, I used to live near Pittsburgh, so I know the Penguins.
You just thought this was a crime podcast. We just took it over and made it a hockey podcast temporarily.
No.
Let's do the Codename Winger series. It's amazing. Now, you've just recently republished it. It's self-published now, right?
Correct, yeah.
And that must have been a labor of love.
I had such a good time writing that series. I love young adult fiction. While my initial works that I published kind of split the difference between romance and young adult, there's still a young adult romance series in my that I still need to republish, which will happen, you know, hopefully next year. But these books really broke away from everything that I'd been doing so far, with the exception of having the hockey element in them, because here you've got this teenager. The series starts when he's a junior in high school, and he's already established as a kid who works for a covert spy agency alongside of his parents.
Yeah.
A gig that he, as the book opens, he's already been doing that for about 5 years in various capacities. He's already in a relationship with a boyfriend that he's been with nearly a year as the books open. And it's a world, too, where being gay just isn't a thing. There's no homophobia in the books. There's no coming out in the books. There's no going through any of that.
Yeah.
God bless you.
It's really about this rather... Sorry, Brad?
I said, God bless you. Last thing we need is another young adult novel about coming out. It's important, but not every novel.
Yes, not every novel.
Exactly. And this was really to show, you know, here's this extraordinary teenager who balances a lot of stuff between playing on his school hockey team, trying to do well in school, including taking some MIT courses because he is a computer whiz.
Right.
Having a boyfriend, doing all this, working for the agency, but then also in the first book, he has to suddenly go be in the field for the first time. He's like the guy who can go solve the problem. And from there, it kind of escalates book to book to book in the four books. Kind of the complexity of the missions, the stakes for each of the missions, you know, really build up to like the big tipping point in book four.
I know you've like finished out this arc. Do you think you're going to have another arc with this character?
As I say in the author's note in four, Theo's journey ends with that book, and this particular portion of his life ends with that book.
Right.
What I want to do in the future is use the organization that I've set up within the Codename Winger books, which is Tactical Operational Support, and move that into an adult-based romantic suspense series.
Hmm.
So you could see the characters that, you know, have come up from this original series providing support to missions and maybe going on missions alongside the characters who would be the primaries in those books. And I really want to do that. I've got some notes kind of sketched out about what a first trilogy might look like for that.
Yeah.
But I had too much fun in that universe, and more as I read more romantic suspense and more mystery, it's like I want to go kind of write in that area and do things where it's not just about the romance, but there's some other really major external force going on as well.
Yeah, I really like that whole world you've built, and you know, it'd be a shame to stop it at four books. I want about 20.
20. Oh, yeah. Goodness. I better get to work.
You better get busy.
Because I am not the fastest writer either.
So I'm curious, when did you first discover LGBT books, and has it been romance from the beginning?
That would really track back to my husband. We met in 95, and I was in my middle 20s. I actually came out because we met and started dating. So that was kind of like my journey started there. He already was reading some of that literature. And so he introduced me to some of it. Like some of the earliest stuff I read was the Gordon Merrick books, for example. So the Peter and Charlie trilogy and the other books that Merrick wrote. Front Runner from Patricia Nell Warren was in there.
Mm-hmm.
The Grant Michaels mystery books, which I think came out in the middle 90s.
It came out in the middle 90s, yeah, because I'm part of Requeered Tales, and we've republished all of them, and we're going to be publishing a surprise later this year, early next year.
Oh, good. I can't wait for that. Because I've still got most of those hardbacks on my bookshelf from the 90s. And then Will had grown up liking Harlequins. Like, he was liking romance, even reading straight romance at the time. And then his romance kind of came up and really became a force in like the middle 2000s and moving into today. I love A Happily Ever After so much that I do read a lot of romance. There is a good mix of like romantic suspense in there, because like I'm just absolutely gaga for authors like Gregory Ashe and C.S. Poe and Leila Rain, and the types of romance with that really intense kind of, you know, suspense thriller mystery plotline that they put through those books. Now I just kind of read that mix. And then LGBTQ literature has always kind of been back there too. Some of my earliest books back there were things like Geography Club from Brent Hartinger, Out of the Pocket from Bill Konigsberg, Alex Sanchez's Rainbow Boys trilogy, mm-hmm. Things like that.
All great books. All great books.
Well, I want to thank you. I love that so many writers are getting into young adults. I think it's really important, and I'm glad there's so many options there for kids, because they didn't exist when we were growing up, that's for sure. And this one's exciting. I mean, it's a spy thriller in a sense, or he certainly is a spy.
It's a spy thriller.
Yeah, it's definitely a spy thriller. Kind of along the lines, if you look at some of its overall inspirations across media, it has a deep root in the Disney show Kim Possible.
Uh-huh.
From the early 2000s, the animated show about Kim, who is essentially a one-person save the world operation with her sidekick Wade, who is behind the computer helping her out, and her sidekick Ron. Theo is very much Wade if Wade had gone out in the field mixing the tech with actually being, you know, physically out there doing the work. And I was at a gay romlet convention in Chicago, and somewhere in that crowd, there was actually somebody's phone had the Kim Possible communicator ringtone on it. And I never found out who they were at that conference, but hearing that, and as I was trying to figure out what I was going to write next, as we flew home from Chicago, the prologue of Tracker Hacker actually got written. And Theo kind of burst onto the page. And a lot of what's still the prologue is very much what I wrote on the way home. I mean, it's been tweaked a little bit over, but mostly that prologue has stayed there through time. And then things like the show Alias with Jennifer Gardner, there's a lot of that feeling of how that show presented being out in the field and doing things and slightly over the top things. And then, of course, you can add in a little James Bond in there too, and even shows like Mr. Robot, which was really entering the zeitgeist as I was writing, especially book two, played a heavy look in that too on how hackers are presented.
You two were romance fans, and actually still are romance fans for a number of years, and then in 2015, one of you came up with this crazy idea to start a podcast, the Big Gay Fiction Podcast. How did that happen?
We read so many books, and neither one of us is a huge fan of blogging. Mm-hmm. And so rather than have to write reviews, it's like, why don't we talk about these books that we like? And it very quickly went from talking specifically about the books and doing reviews to moving out into interviewing authors. Because unless you're an author who goes to Gay Romlet or some of the other, at the time, more regional romance gatherings, you may not get the chance to see your favorite author or hear from your favorite author. And, you know, even now, you know, yeah, there might be a Facebook presence, but not everybody does Facebook Lives or Instagram Lives or, you know, TikTok or something. So it was a way to bring these authors to people in a way that they may not normally get presented. And so it's been a really fun endeavor to do that over, you know, gosh, we're going to start the seventh year in November. Yeah. So it's been a good time.
Well, it's impressive. I'll tell you two just seem so smooth together, and you've been featured in BuzzFeed. You've been featured in Oprah. I could list on and on and on, and I hope I don't offend you with this. Justine and I like to joke around and tell people, don't listen to our earliest episodes, please, which is really not a nice thing to say because we had some outstanding guests at that time. Well, I went back and listened to some of your earliest episodes. You weren't quite as polished then either.
Oh, no.
When did it finally click?
Probably after the first year. I think we got smoother after that first year. And then I think we got smoother again probably in middle 2019. We did a significant technical upgrade in 2019 across the board in the mid part of the year. And I think that we could now hide a lot of our mistakes.
Yeah.
Which helps a lot. And I think we also know how to get what we need when we're recording as opposed to just taking the first cut, which is certainly what we used to do back in the day. It's just like, you know, put it out there and there you go, which I think is important because if we had waited until we perfected it, we may have never started as opposed to being, we are going to start on this first Monday of November, and that is what it's going to be. And here's our plan to get those first four episodes done and just go with it. I think the only thing that made it work a little bit better for us is because Will and I already knew how to talk to each other. I mean, you know, we didn't have to find our chemistry to do that as co-hosts because we already had chemistry that existed because we'd already been a couple for nearly 20 years at that point. So that definitely helped. But, you know, beyond that, it was like just learning the tech and kind of learning what we wanted the show to be. If you've listened to the entire thing, you could probably hear over time how the show has morphed and changed a little bit at a time over the years as we, you know, want to change a little bit what we're doing or how we're doing it. But by and large, it's, you know, it's the same show that it was at its core.
Well, when you first started at the very, very beginning, there were 30 minutes episode with just the two of you. And then you brought your first guests on. Was your plan all along to have guests, or were you just going to be doing reviews or just played as you went along?
Initially, it wasn't supposed to be as many guests as it turned out to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like within the first batch of debut episodes, because we dropped four on that first day, there are guests in one of them because we recorded that at Gay Romlet, which happened just a couple weeks before we were doing the premiere episodes. Then it was just a lot of us, and then we started working in more and more guests. And I enjoy doing interviews. I've got my journalism background, so I'm also used to doing interviews. And it became just a really great way to know authors. Because like readers, we only see the authors that are able to come to Gay Romlet at any one moment.
Mm-hmm.
And we can reach out beyond that. And it's been an incredible way to build friendships and our network out there. As we're recording this, I just finished, you know, episode 323. So
we've
easily interviewed a couple hundred guests at this point.
You guys not only talk about novels and books and authors, you do get a little more into, well, you get a lot more into pop culture, which I think is a nice addition to your show. It makes it a little fun. I don't know anything about pop culture. I sit on YouTube.
We could be your pop culture guide.
You've caught me up on that, and definitely some plays as well.
Yeah, enjoy your trips to Broadway, at least before the pandemic, in the before times.
In the before times. There'll be after times, and at least there's been a few things to watch over the pandemic that have either streamed or turned up somewhere that have at least brought a little bit of live theater.
Well, I started kind of get into a question, and unfortunately, I turned to the negative. I started to talk about Oprah and BuzzFeed, and then I went to talking about how, you know, it was a gradual climb in the beginning. I'd like to go back to Oprah and BuzzFeed when you started getting these accolades. What was the feeling when you found you were listed as one of the shows to listen to on Oprah when you're not reading?
That was a bonkers day. How did we find out? We found out about that from Sarah Wendell from Smart Podcast Trashy Books, who's also on that list of podcasters. And she pinged me and was like, have you seen this? You're on this list. And I squeaked. I literally squeaked. Because it's like, oh my God. And Will thought, Will didn't know what was going on. It's like, come here. Look at this. It was insane. Because we had no idea that we were making that list. And that's really true with any of those lists. The lists don't say, hey, here you are on this thing. Unless they, for some reason, tag you, like if they're putting it up on Twitter or something, which is rare for those kind of lists because there's so many in the list. So to get recognized by Oprah was huge and incredible to see. And then, you know, BuzzFeed and Book Riot and some of these others. I mean, it's really nice that other people appreciate what we're doing because podcasting can happen in a vacuum, essentially, because it goes out and you hear, you know, from various people and you see what your download numbers are. But to get that level of recognition is pretty incredible. It's like getting a bestseller banner on Amazon or something, you know, that, you know, you punched out a little further than the universe that you think you're in.
Yeah, I guess in a lot of ways, it's like being an author. In some ways, it's kind of a lonely job because you're staring at a computer screen and talking in a microphone. And when you're writing, you're typing away. And you see your downloads and you see your reviews and you see your book reviews. But there's not that connection until you really start seeing things like that. That like, wow. I want to tell you, it was a joy meeting you and Will at the Los Angeles Times Book Festival a few years back. I don't remember if we talked podcasting then. I'm not sure if I had it in my head yet. But I do want to thank you when I was getting the show kicked off and talked to Justine and we got on board to do the show. You both were very helpful, very gracious, willing to answer any questions, and I really appreciate that.
You're so welcome. I mean, we love anybody that takes the leap to start a book podcast, especially a queer book podcast. There's not many of us out there. And, you know, the opportunity to get to present our genres and our authors and these books to help people to find them. I mean, I still hear from people who don't realize aspects of these genres exist.
Oh, yeah.
So it's good to have it out there. You know, I wish everybody would start one. You know, there's enough little sub things to talk about it. Even if somebody started a show exactly like ours, talking about romance, or exactly like yours, talking about queer crime, there's so many different ways everybody would approach it that none of us are going to step on each other.
I'm amazed how often I'm asked, you have a podcast about that? Are there really that many crime fiction writers? And I'm like, we're reaching 100 episodes. I'm booked for the next 6 months, and I could easily be booked for the next year if I wanted to be. So the authors are there. We want to bring more readers in, let them know we're here. So good on you for doing that as well. You really blazed the trail, I think.
Now we just need more people to follow the trail.
Yeah.
And start their own shows.
Yeah. Thank you again for being on the show, Jeff. It's been a pleasure to have you on. And again, your show is the Big Gay Fiction Podcast. And Justine, what is the series?
Codename Winger is the name of the series, and it's Tracker Hacker.
Well, again, Jeff, we have so many of our listeners that not only just read mystery, but also read romance. And we're seeing a lot more crossover. Neil Plaxey, who is known as a mystery writer, has now crossed over, and he's doing romance as well. So I'm glad to see people are expanding, not just sticking with one genre. I think it's better. I need to be better at it, and I'm glad to see others are better at it than I am.
Yeah, it's nice to read across many things, especially as a writer, because then you're exposed to more and gives you more ideas on how to approach your own storytelling, too.
Exactly. All right. Well, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been great being here.
Justine, you take care, too.
I will. Glad to have you on, Jeff.
Marco Romanti, it's a pleasure to have you back.
Thanks, Brad. I really appreciate spending time with me.
Given that you write about young adults, I'd like to ask you something.
Sure.
Do you think eventually a writer will come around who will write a young adult queer novel that isn't about coming out?
I don't think so. I think I'm one of the only people that has tried to branch into something different for that audience. But it seems like every queer young adult novel somewhere is about coming out. And I think it's annoying. I think that it's already been done well. People have already done that story extremely well. So I don't have any interest in pursuing that anymore.
Yeah, it's an important story to tell. I mean, most of us, it was not an easy process. We at least have to get a second thought. It was a huge process for me. But I don't want to see it in every film. I don't want to read in every book. And
I think the queer experience, you know, we have the AIDS crisis, which has touched pretty much everybody's life. Mm-hmm. We have coming out. We have Stonewall and hate crimes. And those are kind of the milestones in the queer experience. But it doesn't mean that every book has to be about AIDS or every book has to be about coming out. We are much more than that as a community as well.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I brought it up on the show before. Have you ever seen the movie Big Eden?
I have, yeah.
Okay, well, it's Eden, Montana, I think it is. And what I love about the movie is the name of the town is perfect because it's a small town. It's a love story. And there's maybe a few seconds of somebody dealing with their own internalized homophobia, and that's it. The rest is just a love story, and nobody in the town questions it. It's just, he's a guy who's gay. And it was so refreshing, so refreshing.
I think that's true with when you think about Call Me By Your Name as well. There, it's never really a discussion about is it right or wrong, or is someone gay or straight? It's just about a relationship, a loving relationship. And even the family of the protagonist never really brings it up as something that needs to be discussed.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll see more of those happening. I will say, despite there being so much of the coming out story written, I am ecstatic to see so many queer young adult novels coming out nowadays. Even before this segment, Justine and I interview Jeff Adams from the Big Gay Fiction podcast, and he writes a young adult spy series. And more people I talk to are writing and even adults reading young adult series. So that makes me very happy to see, because that's something that was unheard of when I was growing up. But do you think in young adult in general, do you think with it becoming more and more common to write, do you think we'll see an oversaturation of it? Is that decided in any way?
The pendulum could swing that way. If something is very popular, then you usually see a glut of that same thing. But that's not necessarily bad. What I'm trying to do with my novels is present queer characters that are positive, that feel good about themselves, and that are out and proud, and then have the storyline take a different turn. It can be about the romance, but you know, it's also about murder mysteries and solving a crime and the puzzle and the riddle of it all. But the characters themselves are very positive. They don't have problems with their sexuality. They've accepted it.
Well, thank you for doing that. It's refreshing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, before we get deeper, I'll tell people who you are. Marco Ramonti spent more than 20 years working in the film and television industry, working as a writer, publicist, and photographer. His writing credits include working on the Academy Awards for ABC and being the head writer on game shows, including High Rollers and dozens of TV pilots for all the major studios. In 2019, he wrote a sequel script to Call Me By Your Name titled, Elio. Okay. He is currently a professional script reader for several production companies and A-list film directors. His first queer novel, Murder at White Oak, was published in 2019. Since then, he has published two more novels in his Jake Weston mystery series, The Butcher of Oxford and The Michaelmas Killer, which was released in July 2021. Marco tries to write positive queer role models, as he just said, for a young adult audience while still giving them surprise endings and exciting, twisty whodunits to solve. So, I stumbled over a word, and it's what I want to start off with, and that is the title of the book, The Michaelmas Killer. I had to look it up. What is Michaelmas, and what is the significance of using it in the title?
People ask that. It's the Feast of St. Michael, which is the Feast of the Archangels. It's celebrated on September 29th. But the reason that I have it in the title is at Oxford, they have three semesters, like we would think of for college. They have the Michaelmas, Hilary, and the Trinity. So that's the way to divide it up instead of saying, you know, fall, winter, spring, the way we do here. So all of the action in the third novel takes place during the Michaelmas term at Oxford.
Interesting. I heard those referred to in the novel, and I didn't know that was the common usage that they used. I thought that was something that you did for the novel's purpose. So
no, it dates way back to all English schools have different sort of semi-religious terms for the way they divide up the school semesters.
Well, I guess I should know you well enough to know that you wouldn't just toss it in for no reason. I do know you well enough to know that.
Everything has a reason.
Exactly. So I got a question about it, though. The first Jake Weston mystery was a paranormal story. Mm-hmm. And then you followed that up with a a time travel novel. You've gone back to paranormal. We have ghosts again. What was the reason for doing that?
I thought ghosts are interesting. And the fans of my books, being young adults, love those kind of twists in a story. So I couldn't just give them a simple procedural kind of a novel or just a police novel. They want something that has ghosts or has some sort of a different element. And interesting, when I was doing my research, more people in England believe in ghosts than believe in a higher power, believe in a divine creator. So ghost stories, I think they're interesting. Also, I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if someone was murdered and their ghost came back to try to help solve the crime? Because they'd be interested, the ghost would be interested in having the murderer brought to justice. So in a way, some of the ghosts of the victims in this third novel I wrote are trying to help the sleuths and the police try to solve the crime so that they can be at rest.
Yeah, because as a ghost, that would be hard to do on your own.
Exactly, exactly. So it's a bit of a sixth sense kind of a thing where there's ghosts who are, they feel wronged and they want to make it right.
Well, I know it makes Justine happy. She likes both paranormal and time travel. She's thrilled over both of them. In fact, if I let her, probably every week would be a mystery that includes paranormal or sci-fi or time travel. I don't know why I keep saying sci-fi. And I shouldn't say that. She doesn't get my permission to recommend books, but we're pretty much on the same wavelength as to try to give variety. So there's not an issue there. This is going to be an odd question to ask you right from the beginning, but there's a reason I'm going to ask that. And okay, we'll get to that. What is the harshest criticism you've received?
That's a good question. I would say when I killed a main character. I killed a main character in my first novel. I don't want to say who for people that haven't read it, but I got a lot of torches and pitchforks coming after me when I did that. And I think I learned a lesson. First of all, I learned don't kill main characters. But I think also when I started to read all these emails, I realized that people were really drawn in and engaged with the character. So I must have done something right to make them so upset that they actually reached out to me to write, to tell me that they were mad that I had killed somebody off. When I think about a couple of my favorite movies, like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, you know, they die at the end, and mm-hmm. Gladiator, Maximus dies at the end. So it's not never done that the protagonist dies, but you have to be careful when you do something like that.
Yeah, I was thinking of Thelma and Louise also.
Thelma and Louise, exactly. Great characters, and it's a bit of a downer if you kill the main character, but it can also be very cathartic and kind of important. I mean, Thelma and Louise, it was very important that they died at the end.
Yeah, I agree. And well, Butch Cassidy and Sundance, even though the movie was very, very loosely based on reality, we know at the end they did die. So that was kind of a given when you started watching that one. But it's kind of like pets or animals. You can slaughter people, but don't shoot a dog.
Exactly.
And know that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would never kill a dog in a book.
Yeah. I saw, what was it I was reading or listening to critique an author being interviewed, and they hinted
that the dog was going to be killed, and people were outraged. It didn't happen. It was part of the tension, and that was unacceptable to people. So the rabbit in the pot is a rare exception to killing an animal.
And even so, that's kind of horrible. The fatal attraction thing is horrible.
Yeah. But you know what? I love that film, and I watch it now, and it's probably one of the worst movies I've ever seen. I don't know what I saw in it, but it's pretty over the top.
They paid a fortune for that script, too, by the way.
Did they really?
Yeah, that's a very, very expensive script that was produced. Yeah. Every once in a while, a script will go over $1 million for someone, and that's a lot of money to pay for a script, pay for 120 pages of writing.
Yeah, wow. That's pretty amazing.
And it's usually really bad movies that get the most money, like The Last Boy Scout. Do you remember that movie?
I remember the title.
Bruce Willis movie.
Okay, that was going to be my guess, yeah.
Or Radio Flyer. There were 2 million dollar price tags on those scripts. And they're movies that people can't even remember these days.
Was Radio Flyer a Rob Reiner?
I'm trying to remember who produced that. I think
it rings a bell.
Yeah, you might be right about that.
Well, and actually, I'm glad you brought that up. It is interesting that, and I'm not surprised that the biggest flack you got was killing off a main character, but that's actually not the reason why I asked the question. Hmm. When you were on the show before, we talked about some of the criticism that you've gotten regarding Jake and Jake's life. In this novel, you made some changes to Jake's life, and significant changes. And because we talked about before, I'm curious as if to know the changes you've made, and you can talk about them. Were they in response to the feedback that you had gotten?
They were. And you know what? I listened really carefully to criticism from fans and from readers. And one of the things that I heard a lot was that Jake, the main character, was too over the top. He was too good looking and too smart and too rich and all of these things, which I felt a little prickly about that because I'm trying to present a positive role model. So I wanted to make him a bit over the top. Think of Bruce Wayne. You know, Bruce Wayne is good looking and rich and athletic and smart. But so for the Jake character in this third book, what I did do was not to make it kind of like a story of Job, but I did sort of take things away from him. I took away the money and took away the boyfriend and even gave him a bad haircut. And so people, just to see what happens to a character when you give them those challenges and when you pull the rug out a little bit from a main character. And I think it actually helped the narrative of the third book by setting up those challenges.
Did you enjoy stirring the pot in Jake's life to see how he would respond or how you would have him respond?
I absolutely did. A writer that I really admire, a screenwriter, Aaron Sorkin, you probably know, you've heard of him.
Oh, once or twice.
Yeah. He says that every plot is you just chase your protagonist up a tree. That's act one. And act two, you throw rocks at them. And then the resolution is you let them out of the tree. And so that's really what part of what storytelling is just setting up challenges for your characters and then seeing how they weasel their way out of them.
Yeah, you mentioned Bruce Wayne, and actually, one thing about Bruce, as perfect as everything in his life, he has a very, very dark side to him. So the whole, you know, world isn't all rainbows and lollipops for him either. I have a bigger issue with Superman, who I find way too perfect. I find him the most uninteresting superhero there is.
Right, because a character like Superman is only really challenged by villains who also have superpowers. I mean, the thing about Bruce Wayne is at least he's a human being. If he can fight other human beings. But Superman, you have to bring someone who can fly or who has laser vision to be able to give him a proper villain. Every good hero needs a proper villain.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something interesting. You know what Superman and Batman and Harry Potter and let's see, Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, what they all have in common?
I could sit here forever trying to come up with the reason, but no, I want to hear it.
Dead parents. When you have a hero like that, Superman, parents dead on Krypton. Then he comes to Earth and his father dies, his adopted father. Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz lives with Auntie M. No one knows where her parents are. Harry Potter, dead parents. Batman, dead parents. Spider-Man, dead parents. So part of the reason for that, I think, is not only dead parents, also they're usually an orphan. They're usually an only child. And I think the reason for that is you want your main character to sort of be isolated so that when they go on their journey, they can meet other allies along the way. If, you know, if Harry Potter had had four siblings, it wouldn't have been the same kind of story. He has to meet people along the way.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly were rooting for that poor kid.
Exactly, yeah.
Having read so many scripts and bring that up, do you see patterns or formulas, and are they similar to what you see in novels?
Yes and no as far as novels. I mean, there are two kinds of scripts. One is a spec script, which is a completely original or semi-original idea. And then the other type of script is adapted. So it's taking a novel and then adapting it into a script, which I think is much harder because you have a great book like Dune is coming out. I read the script to that recently. Dune is a novel that everybody loves. And taking something that is so dense and has so much to it and then distilling it into a script is a tricky process. But there are formulas. There are plenty of books out there that say, you know, there are seven basic scripts. And then there's another one that says there are 20 master plots. And the thing about it is there aren't a lot of new ideas. So there are definite formulas. And we like to tell ourselves the same kind of stories. We like underdog stories, and we like adventure stories, and we like quest stories, and we like escape stories. So I think there's a reason that we respond to those kind of storytelling and the reason that we tell ourselves the same stories over and over and over again.
Given all that you've done with Jake and that you threw at him in this novel, can the reader expect a happy ending?
I've been asked that question a couple of times because the first two books didn't necessarily have happy endings. They had more sort of cliffhanger endings. Mm-hmm. I will say that this third book has a satisfying ending. So I'm not going to give away, you know, what happens at the end, but it's definitely much more satisfying, I think, than the other two books. Although I do leave room, I sort of hint at what the fourth book would be, which would be another time travel book for Justine.
I like that. I like hearing it's a satisfying ending. I don't want to be told there's a happy ending. I just want a satisfying ending. They are very different.
Absolutely. And I think people say romance, if you write a romance and to call it a romance, it has to have sort of a happily ever after. And I hate that because no relationship is going to end happily ever after. Eventually somebody dies, right?
Yes. Well, this brings up an interesting question. I had this debate with somebody, I believe it was last month, Brokeback Mountain. Is that a love story or not?
It is a love story, absolutely. But if it's it wouldn't be called a romance. The people at Goodreads would go after you if you tried to say it was a romance. But it's a tragic love story like Romeo and Juliet.
Okay, there you go. You answered it better than the person I was discussing it with because I was really argumentative. I'm like, it's not. But you're right. It is a love story. It's just not a romance. And I was confusing the two.
Right. Tragic love story. And that's pretty popular. If you think about Love Story itself, remember that movie and novel where she dies at the end and she dies at the beginning, actually, and had cancer. And that's another – it's a tragic love story.
It's funny. Maurice, my husband, had never seen it before and – What's Up, Doc? Is one of our favorite comedies, and they've referenced that film at the very end. And so he's finally like, we've got to watch it. And he was less than enthusiastic about it. It's dated, but yeah.
It could be a downer, yeah. But Ryan O'Neill's good in every movie that he does.
Yeah, exactly. He was great in both of those. He was fabulous in What's Up, Doc? I wish his career had stayed strong like it had there for a while. So let's jump right into the book. I know I keep saying it wrong. It's just simple, Michaelmas or Michaelmas.
Yeah, Michaelmas.
What is the plot of the Michaelmas killer?
Well, it's interesting. It's at Oxford. And so in the first book, my characters were 16, 17. The second book, they're 17, 18. And now in this third book, they're 18, 19. So they're more college age. And the basic plot line is that there's a serial killer at Oxford, and he's living in the tunnels underneath the city of Oxford. And he's abducting young men who on the outside seem to be gay men. He's using Grindr and other apps to be able to attract these people. And he abducts them. And then 7 days later, he brings the body back and leaves the body back in their bed, tucked back into bed with a piece of sea glass in their hand. And that's the only evidence that he leaves behind. And so these murders get closer and closer to my main character, Jake, which make him want to be involved in trying to figure out who's doing these things.
Well, I got to, I'll have to write one day because I love serial killers.
You know, I was doing some research there. Do you know every person, or the average person, passes by 36 murderers in their lifetime? Isn't that a scary stat?
That's really creepy.
Yeah.
That's really creepy.
The other thing that's really crazy is that 40% of the people who commit murder get away with it. So it's nearly half.
I had read years ago, and I don't know if it was speculation or if there was evidence to show that a huge number of the unsolved murders are actually done by a small number of people.
I think that that could be true. They say that the average in the U.S. that there's 50 active serial killers at any one time. But in the 80s, that number was triple that. There were up to about 150 serial killers working at any one time. So it's crazy. I mean, the amount of psychopaths is even crazier. If you get onto a jumbo jet, say you're flying to Australia, mm-hmm. there's a good chance that statistically – there's about 6 or 7 clinical psychopaths on that flight with you.
Okay. For a person that loves murder mysteries, it's hard to give me the chills, and you just gave me the chills.
That's scary, isn't it, to think about on the plane with you. There's next time you get on a plane, just think about that. If there's about 300 people on the plane or 250 people on the plane, and especially they say that there are more psychopaths who are involved in business – so you're more likely to meet a psychopath in the business world than in just a normal everyday world.
You know, I hate flying, and it's not because I fear flying. I just find it dreadfully boring and uncomfortable, and now you've just added fear in there to me. So thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Just the service I provide.
Now, back to these tunnels. Do they really exist?
They do exist. So part of my research was it was interesting to find out that, I mean, Oxford is 45 different universities, and it's been around for 800 years. So those tunnels, they're under the Oxford Covered Market. They're under all of the major tourist destinations in Oxford. And it used to be the Bodleian Library was where they had the books, and they would transport the books in these tunnels through conveyor belts to get them to the reading rooms. Because back in the old days, the library, you could never take home a book. You were just allowed to read a book in a reading room, and the librarian mm-hmm. would go and get the book for you. The regular people, the students, weren't allowed in the stacks. So that was the librarian's job. And they had this vast network of tunnels that would go to where the books were stored in these tombs and conveyor them up to the reading room so that the students could see them. So those tunnels are actually there. I can't wait to go there and visit the tunnels.
Oh, you can actually visit them.
I saw a YouTube video, yeah, where guys went down underneath the covered market, underneath a butcher shop, which I referenced. So all the places that I mention in the book, for the most part, are real places. So when I say you can land your helicopter in the back of the Mason Arms pub, you can actually land your helicopter there.
Interesting. That's good. And so given research, what is up with these chapter names? I can't even pronounce one.
The one you're trying to pronounce is probably Joe La Boca Flode.
Yes.
Which is a great thing that I realized, I came across this while I was doing research, It's an Icelandic tradition. During the war, there wasn't paper. I mean, there wasn't regular gifts, but there was lots of paper. So mm-hmm. they started a tradition where they gave books out on Christmas Eve. So Jólabókaflóð literally means in Icelandic, it means the Christmas book flood. And still to this day, they publish a catalog, which comes out in October, November. And Icelanders, who are they're voracious readers, they pick books and they give them out as part of this tradition. So I do a lot of research and I have a lot of these kind of trivia and weird facts, and I like to give them back to the readers because I just think they're fun.
Well, it's great to hear about the Icelandic story. Every December, memes go around that people in Iceland do this book exchange. And it's one of those things I'm like, well, that's really kind of cool. I wonder if that's real, you know, because you never know 90% of the time when it comes to a meme. It's very good to hear that that is true. And I certainly would never have known what the name of it was called. I think I'll just stick with book exchange.
Right. Well, the book, or you can call it the book flood.
Okay, I mean, book flood. There we go.
I was doing research on the Oxford, the Botanical Garden, which is a location in part of my novel. And I found out that Lewis Carroll used the Botanical Garden as part of his inspiration for Alice in Wonderland, which I think those kind of facts are just interesting. And if you can add them in, you know, without making them obvious, I think the readers kind of enjoy learning a thing or two along the way. Another interesting fact about the botanical is it's actually sitting over a Jewish cemetery. That's kind of weird, isn't it? So I have ghosts in the botanical, and it would be a place where I think if you were looking for ghosts, you could probably find one there.
That's interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah.
You mentioned adapting books to film and how that tends to be more difficult than writing a fresh script. And you made me think of something. I just stumbled on a movie on YouTube. And I've mentioned before that on this many, many times that Lawrence Block is my favorite mystery writer. Absolutely love Lawrence Block. The series he writes that I enjoy a lot, it's his Burglar series. And one of his books, Burglars Can't Be Choosers, it's the second book in the series. Bernie is kind of a, well, I'm not going to say he's a gentleman burglar, but kind of a gentleman burglar. Well, in the movie, they changed the name to just Burglar. It starred Whoopi Goldberg as Bernice the burglar, which I'm okay with. Changing genders is fine. Bruce Willis apparently turned down the role originally, and Whoopi got the job. But if that had been where the change had been made and they left it at that, I would have been fine with it. But they destroyed the novel. I mean, it was such an injustice. And as a result of that movie, Lawrence Block has said he has gone out of his way in all of his novels. I don't know how he does it. You may know a way he can do it. He says he writes them to make sure that they are not easily adaptable to film. How difficult of a process is it to actually... Because one of the things I'm thinking of, that series is written in first person, whereas movies, generally speaking, aren't.
Yeah, movies are filmed third person. It's the camera's point of view.
Right.
So when a book is first person, it's some changes need to be made. To adapt a book faithfully to the writer is a question. I mean, when Peter Jackson did Lord of the Rings, he tried to stay very close to the text. And still, you know, I think he did a good job, although some fans are still upset that certain things are missing. And I think that's the biggest challenge is a book can be 500 pages, 1,000 pages, and you can put in whatever you want to put in. But a screenplay is 120 pages. So you need to distill it down. And every line in a screenplay needs to either develop character or move the plot forward. So I think that's the challenge is screenplays are just so short. And if you have a very dense novel, then it's a difficult process to figure out what are you keeping in and what are you taking out?
Yeah, the whole argument of the movie's never as good as the book, to me, it's kind of silly. It's a hard comparison to make. So I don't mind that there's changes in an adaption. It's when it's a bad adaption, which this was. For, you know, I hear The Grapes of Wrath is a great film. I will never watch it because I love the book too much. And I respect that they cannot put that book into a 2-hour movie. So there are apples and oranges in that sense.
What about like Gatsby? I love Gatsby, the book. And they've made at least 2 films, the Redford film and the Leonardo DiCaprio film, which are both okay. But they're, they don't compare to the gorgeous Fitzgerald prose in the book.
I would agree with you. I haven't seen the DiCaprio one. The Robert Redford version was beautiful to look at, but that was where it ended. It was it did not capture anything. To me, it was very dull, and I didn't find anyone interesting in the movie as compared to the book.
Let me give you an example of something that's interesting about point of view. So, you know, Suzanne Collins, she wrote The Hunger Games. Mm-hmm. Those books, well, she was the most, number one, most popular author on Kindle when those books came out. She sold more books than anybody else electronically ever has at that time. The problem with those books is they're told first person. She tells them from Katniss's point of view. And when you have a conflict where she's sending 24 kids into a gladiator type of environment where the kids are set up to murder one another, mm-hmm. you know that Katniss isn't going to die because the book is told from her point of view. If they're telling it first person, she can't die. Mm-hmm. And she did 3 books that way where they're all from Katniss's point of view. So my argument would be that the movies are actually better than the books, because at least in the movie, they move it to third person, right? And the Jennifer Lawrence character, even though you know she's probably not going to die in the movie, at least she has a chance of dying.
Right.
Whereas in a book, if it's first person, if you're listening to that person narrate the story, they're not going to die.
Was it, I'm trying to remember from school, one of the ones they make you read, is it The Red Badge of Honor? There's one of those
Red
classics.
Red Badge of Courage?
Red Badge of Courage. Was that written in first person from a dead person? Is that the novel I'm thinking of?
Yeah, it's pretty rare. The Lovely Bones, I think, is also first person written from a dead point of view, a dead person's point of view.
I think you can get away with that once in a millennia.
Yeah, it's just like a film can maybe get away with not doing a third person kind of a point of view, but it's really, really tricky to be able to do. It's like when you hear a voiceover in a film, that's them trying to go into a first person narrative, and mm-hmm. it rarely, rarely works. Usually it destroys the film when they start going into voiceovers.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, I'm sure there's some that have done well, but I can't think of any off the top of my head.
The best one with a voiceover, I think, is The Shawshank Redemption. So they do, Morgan mm-hmm. Freeman does some voiceover in that. But see, it's not the main character doing the voiceover, which I think makes it better. When they did voiceover in Blade Runner, Ridley Scott and Harrison Ford were so upset over the way they did that, that Ridley almost wanted to take his name off the film.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Just because, again, it takes the jeopardy away from the character if you have them doing narration through the whole film or through the whole book. Now, your book, your first book is told first person from the sleuth's point of view.
Yes.
And I think mystery writers do that a lot. And it works well for mysteries because the reader is following along with the person trying to solve the crime with them. But we know that the sleuth isn't going to be in any real jeopardy because he's telling the story.
Yeah. I write first person because that's what I prefer to read. And like you said, I like to know – that way I know that the reader is getting the same information as the sleuth.
And it's also fun to be in their head.
Yes.
Right? I mean, you can write a lot of clever things of what that person is thinking, which can make a really enjoyable experience for the reader. So there's give and takes with it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I was I make fun of Gregory Ashe. I brought up that I don't guarantee a happy ending in my stories. I'm not going to say if there will or won't be, you know. And he said, "Well, does that mean you foresee the day that someday you'll kill Mitch?" And I'm like, "Greg, my novels are written from first person. Mitch is not going to talk from the grave. No, I'm not going to play that game." He was kind of embarrassed, yes. But
although what I thought you could do is you could kill Mitch and then have somebody else pick up the pen and start writing. So finish the book from somebody else's point of view.
you know, that's actually would be an interesting thing to do. No, I'm not going to do it. I could see somebody doing that. Yes.
Yeah.
No, I can assure my readers that there will not be a happy ending, but Mitch will not die, at least not on paper.
Well, see, what I did in the third book was anything that has to do with the killers or the police, that's all done in third person. But the chapters where my main character, where Jake Weston is, I tell his chapters first person. So I go kind of back and forth. And so he can still be in jeopardy. See, I want it both ways. I want him to be in jeopardy, but I also want the reader to be able to hear what's inside his head.
I commend you because a lot of people try the changes in point of view. Some do it very well and some don't. It's a challenge to do it.
It is. So when Jake is in the room, I'm telling his point of view. But when he's not in the room, so when the killer is doing his naughty things, that's all third person omniscient. I mean, these are kind of discussions or decisions that the writer makes at the very beginning. Are you going to tell it present tense or past tense? Are you going to tell it first person or third person? And you start to plan that right at the very beginning. As soon when you have the blank page, that's the first thing you kind of do.
I was going to go to awkward questions, but I have to ask you a question first.
Sure.
Something you made me think of earlier when you were talking about the lead in The Hunger Games, that you know she's not going to be killed. As a writer, I shouldn't even be asking this, but I'm just always amazed when this happens. I'm watching a movie, and I know the outcome. I know the character. Like, let's take Black Widow. Mm-hmm. Okay. That was a prequel. So I know she's going to survive in Black Widow.
Right.
Why the hell am I so scared shitless when things look like it's going to be the end for her? That happens all the time in movies and TV shows. I mean, that really shows a skill.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think prequels are a very tricky thing to do for just that reason. If you're doing a prequel, you know all those characters in the prequel are going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So, but people, I'll tell you what it really is. Readers and people, also film watchers, moviegoers, they fall in love with characters. So you just want more of certain characters. And so you will take any story that the creator will give you just so long as you can visit that character again. And I think that's the reason, you know, that's the reason you're scared for Black Widow or for any character, because you love that character so much, you don't even want to see them get hurt.
Yeah.
So I think that's what it is. It's really all about character. And character to me is more important than plot. The story, and that's what people say. People say they love my characters, even the big publishers and the streaming services. They love the characters. They think the story is good, but the characters they love. I think that's the trick. You have to have characters that people will engage with. Because if they don't love the characters, then it doesn't matter what you do with the story. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
Character has to come first.
And I guess that's really a testament to the writer in the sense, bringing Black Widow back up, is obviously you care about the character. They've done a great job of making her somebody you really do care about. Otherwise, you wouldn't care if she was in danger. So
right.
The fact that I know that she's going to survive, yet it still makes me edgy, is a testament to the writers.
Exactly.
And going back to Lawrence Block and the burglar series, what's interesting to me is not many people know his name for whatever reason. He's been highly praised by the Mystery Writers of America. He's gotten Lifetime Achievement Awards. But one thing I will say about his burglar series, it's madcap, and I don't think he plays fair to the reader. I think most of the time, the reader cannot figure out the crime, which usually I would find unacceptable in any way, shape, or form. But I like his main character and the other characters in that series so much that I'm willing to accept that. So I think if you make somebody and you can like to Bernie, I just find likable, but you can write a great character who you love to hate. But
right.
I think as long as you can make a reader fall in love with the character, you can get away with almost anything.
I call it the Seinfeld effect. You know, the Seinfeld, when they were producing that show, they said it was a show about nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason people loved the show is because of the characters. They would come in to watch those four characters just eat in a diner and chat with one another.
Mm-hmm.
People just love the show because they love the characters. Nothing has to happen in the show. It's just give me the characters and let them just sit around and talk to each other.
Definitely. Are you ready for your awkward question?
Yes, give it to me.
Okay. So hang tight while I spin the wheel here. Is English the first language of your proofreader?
You know, I'm one of those people who enjoy proofreading. And I have several other beta readers that help me proofread as well. I think, and you can probably confirm this for me, you never actually finish writing a novel. You can always go back and wordsmith something. There's always changes mm-hmm. that you would want to make. Eventually, you just have to say, okay, I'm done proofing this. I'm done editing this. I'm going to let it go out into the world and be done with it. So proofing is a necessary but important skill. And English as a first language, I think, is important for proofreaders.
Yeah, unless it's a translation. Definitely. Though I will tell you, I've read some novels where I really wondered if the proofreader was an English speaker.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and there, I am constantly thinking of things that I could have done differently in my other novels. And will I ever rewrite this or rewrite that? I will say one, as much as I enjoy the series that I write, there's one thing I wish I did differently in my first novel. I don't know if you read it.
Abiding
in a Bathhouse is because it was a bathhouse in such a closed environment where we knew the killer had to be one of these small groups of people. I wish I had written it as a cozy.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
A cozy in a bathhouse. I thought, what a missed opportunity. So anybody out there wants to steal that idea, go for it, because I missed it.
Well, with your series, I thought that the clever thing is the hook about a body in, because you mm-hmm. can use that in so many ways. You could do a body in the barracks, a body in the basement, a body, you know, you can, there's 50 books mm-hmm. just with that hook for that title.
Yeah, I was interviewed on a different show just recently, and they asked me how many titles I have. And I said, I think it's 2 pages of a body of a 99% of them were probably garbage. But, you know, I just sat down a few times and just as things hit me, there's a couple that I love and I don't know how I'll do them, but they'll come out one way or another.
See, but that's great because you've already given yourself the start. You already have that little seed to get ready to start a new idea.
Well, and I bring this up a lot of times. I hear writers all the time frustrated over they're writing a great story, but they just cannot think of a title at all. Where I'm the opposite. A Body in a Bathhouse hit me way before the story ever did. And because of that, the whole a body thing, now the titles do hit me first. So A Body on the Hill hit me before I ever knew what The Hill was going to be. I knew it was going to be The Hill. And then I immediately knew, okay, well, The Hill has to be the Hollywood sign where that's located. And that developed into the story. So it's interesting. Everybody gets, when people say, where do you get your ideas from? It's usually hard to answer that one, but that one's pretty easy for me.
The Michaelmas Killer had a different title until the week before it was published, when I realized that someone had taken the same title. And I had to change it so that there wouldn't be confusion.
That's really common. It's really common to change a title at the very last minute.
Right, right. And I actually like this title. The title that I had before was also a good title, but, you know, what can you do? Somebody took it.
I stopped writing a thriller. I had – the working title was Trafficked, and it was about human trafficking. And I don't know. I was sweating like crazy. I was so anxious because I was enjoying writing this thriller so much. I don't know why I stopped it. Someday I'll go back to it. But I looked and there are dozens and dozens and dozens of books titled Trafficked. Yeah. So I considered, will I ever change the name? I think if I ever publish it, I'll keep the name because it just really fits. But I understand the reluctance, definitely.
Well, people will start to find you. They'll search under your name and then read whatever you're writing if they love you. Mm-hmm. So, but titles are important. I think titles make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, Marco, it's been great to have you back on.
Thank you so much, Brad. I've so enjoyed talking to you and I wish we could do it every week. I would talk to you even if we weren't recording it.
We can make that happen. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Yeah. So remind everybody, it's Marco Ramonti, and he is the author of the Jake Weston Mystery Series, and the most recent is the Michaelmas Killer. Thank you again.
Thanks, Brad.